Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Coaching Uncaged. Today, we are talking intersectionality. Now, this is a new concept to me. I say new, it's new and old. There are themes and ideas that sit within this that are things that we kind of know already when we think about coaching, when we think about diversity, when we think about inclusion. But there are other aspects to this that I'm going to be exploring with my two guests today. We have Lu Chu and we have Myra Khan. And we're going to be exploring the work they do, both within organizations and with individuals, exploring intersectionality and where it sits within the coaching world. So to start us off, why don't we do some introductions? Myra, if you could introduce yourself first, that would be great.
Sure. Thanks, Robert. So I'm Myra Khan. I work as a counselor, a coach, therapeutic coach, and as a supervisor.
Awesome. Brilliant. And Lu?
Hi. Thanks for having me on today. So I am a culture and relationships coach. I'm actually quite new in my coaching journey. So I'm partway through my training at the moment. I'm working with both organizations and individual clients. A lot of it at the moment around allyship. So I'm really happy to be here in this conversation.
Brilliant stuff. And that word allyship is something that's around a lot at the moment, and a lot of people are speaking about it. And I know that some of the work that we're doing around sort of social impact, allyship is part of that, and that sort of collaborative nature of the work that we do. And I know Lu said that she was quite new to this work or to coaching, but I know that she's not new to this field. From the conversations that we've had about some of the other work that she's done. So Lu, if you could just kind of paint a little bit of a picture around sort of the other work that you've done that have led you to this space.
Thank you. A lot of it kind of stemmed from my academic interest as an undergraduate. So I come from a sociology and a philosophy background. So for me, existentialist coaching really fit with what I was doing. But the big thing that I was really interested in was how people form their sense of identities. And so really big research into identity construction. And then throughout my career, it's been about supporting people who are progressing in different ways. So most of my career has been within education or students' unions. And so whether that's been career progression, whether that's been overcoming barriers, access, and a lot of that is working with people from different classes, international students, and became really interested in the language and dialogue that students were bringing in. But also, the older I got in that sector, seeing them go out into the workplace and having those conversations with people about how when the identity shifts and what that might mean for their sense of themselves. And so, yeah, that really brought me in line to look at pursuing coaching full time.
I really love that stuff around identity. A lot of my own coaching work sort of sits with this idea of sort of, you know, who are we showing up in the space in this moment? And as some of you may know, in my past life, I trained as an actor. And when I came to coaching, I love this idea that the questions we were asking our clients are often the same questions that an actor's asking themselves about the character that they're playing, which also kind of drew me into the world of narrative coaching and narrative therapy. So I love that sort of sense of, so who are we being in this moment? And sort of the phrase intersectionality was kind of brought to my attention by Myra. We were having a conversation about therapy and about coaching and about how these things sort of cross over and work. And she kind of threw the word into the mix, and I was kind of like going, okay, wait a minute, let's back up. So it'd be great if you could sort of explain to us, Myra, what is it we mean when we sort of use that word intersectionality?
Sure. I do want to answer that question, but I actually want to go back a second because you talk about training as an actor and I'm sat here smiling because I'm like, yeah, I come from an acting, directing background myself. So prior to training as a counsellor and a coach, I was in the media and I did a lot of film, TV stuff, but very much kind of grew up on stage in that respect. And absolutely, what we are asking of our clients, and I think what we're asking of ourselves, and it is linked to intersectionality, is what is somebody's lived experience? What is their truth in the world? And for me, intersectionality gives us a framework to understand why somebody, any individual, will have the experience that they have out there in the world. And so essentially, in a nutshell, as I understand intersectionality, is about all the different aspects and different factors and characteristics that make up our identity. And when we go out into the world, we are being related to because of all those different factors. And where it intersects then is for each of those different factors or characteristics, we hold different levels of power, privilege, or equally powerlessness. And so it's overall then, where do all those different levels of power and powerlessness intersect as we kind of cross-check or cross-reference and intersect all those different aspects of our characters or all of those different aspects of our identity? And I think that's really important when we go back to your point, Robert, around, well, who am I? What's my lived experience? What's my narrative? What's my journey? We talk about narrative, we talk about arcs of a journey. And when we sit with clients, we're trying to make sense of their journey, their narrative, that arc. But we cannot do that if we don't take account of their identity and their intersectionality. So for me, the two things are completely intertwined.
Okay, so I'm really sort of drawn by this idea that our identity and our intersectionality are these kind of two separate but also joined aspects. And I guess one, or perhaps they both inform each other. And this idea that our lived experience, those different facets that make us us, that sort of create that identity, are also those intersections coming together to create that. And it makes me think about, as a coach, when I'm working in the space, how am I holding that? Or how do I begin to explore what that is with my client without using language that I then have to explain?
I mean, I'm happy to kind of jump in with that first. Sorry, Lou. But I'm kind of sat here going, absolutely. It's not about potentially using that terminology with our clients. I think it's about what it gives us is a framework that then helps us to explore it with our clients. So I'm not going to sit with a client and go, right, well, let's understand your intersectionality. Let's try and map it out. But what I will absolutely be thinking of, though, is alongside my client is to think about, well, what is their lived experience? And in that lived experience, how does their identity both impact that experience, but also vice versa? How does the lived experience impact on somebody's sense of self and identity? And you mentioned just now, Robert, you know, it's like they interrelate. Absolutely. When I teach intersectionality and identity, I absolutely talk about it as a constant feedback loop between our identity, our what I call social location, our place in the world, and how the two then are constantly feeding back, because that is how intersectionality is then created.
Yeah, I really like that term, our social location, how we are placed in the world, how we show up in the world. And I know, Lou, you do a lot of work around that sort of that identity piece. I'm just curious what your thoughts are right now as we're talking about this.
So for me, it comes up in quite a natural way. So one of the, as well as the kind of existentialist background, I also kind of pull into multiplicity theories. And so one of the things that I do with clients is kind of working out who's showing up. And so at the moment, I'm playing around with this idea that the inner self that is present isn't the same as somebody's sense of identity, which is made up of all of these different factors. But as Myra said, how do our lived experiences inform that? And, you know, how are those inner selves themselves shaped by their own lived experiences, their thoughts, their feelings, their behaviours? And the thing that comes up a lot for my practice, where I'm focusing on culture and relationships, there is the internal sense of identity construction, but also how other reacting to how other people perceive our identities. Because we have, you know, we have the things that you can see about people, and then the things that you can't. And so I think for us as coaches, knowing that we have this framework and understanding of intersectionality helps us then work out when a different self, or, you know, or a different part of themselves are being presented in that space. And that can get quite confusing sometimes, because what we, one of the things that we try and do as coaches is perhaps help the coachee understand their worldview and how they formed, you know, how they form their sense of selves. And I know one of the things that we spoke about, Robert, that I think was quite new for you was the idea of code switching. And so if somebody is presenting in a way that this is the type of context I'm in, I need to present myself in this way. And so for me, it might be, okay, well, I might need to show up in a space and purpose, you know, put some makeup on and look a bit older than I naturally do, having Asian genetics. Because otherwise I have this whole young female Asian thing, less so nowadays. But yeah, being able to kind of switch codes, the types of language that we use, we might not, you know, we might not lean into our dialects or accents as much. And so knowing that there's different facets that a coachee can show up in that space helps us really build on that relationship and build that trust. Because when something does come out for them, it's knowing that the coach themselves are comfortable with some of these topics, partly because people still struggle to talk about race. And so if you want to talk about, you know, my experiences as a person of color who is female with a mental health disability, makes, you know, it's for some people, your shoulders go up and you do that internal panic. And so what I love about it is how we can use the framework to support our clients, but actually for ourselves as well, being aware of our own sense of self-identity. How do we show up? What are we bringing into that space? And that can include our own bias, because we only have our own experiences to live by. So, yeah, so I'm throwing everything out there.
as you were talking there, I was like, you know, which strand of that do we begin to untangle first? And, you know, I really like this idea of, you know, that internal external, you know, how are we in on the inside and how are we showing up on the outside, and how those two influences are creating our showing upness in the world right now. And, you know, I can remember back in the days when I was doing auditions that you knew there was a way you needed to show up in a space. And as I think about it now, I go, for if you are a coachee, that idea of having to show up not as yourself but as a facet of yourself can start to fracture who you are and create that sense of loss of identity. And perhaps this is the work that helps us to kind of start to pull back all those facets, or shine a light on all those different aspects of the self, to go, these are all the parts that make up the you, and they're all important, as opposed to one's more important than the other in a particular context. So you said there a few times about the framework, and I guess I kind of want to get a little bit closer to understanding what the framework is. I don't know if Myra, if you can sort of give a sense of, for somebody very new to this, how they might see or feel the framework.
Yes, I'll try to make this really quite simplistic, which is, if we think of, and what I often use is the image of, if you think of like a wheel, and in the center, think of the wheel with all the spokes coming off it. If in the middle we have this, what we call identity, and all the spokes coming off it, each spoke being a different fact or characteristic of your identity. So within us, we carry this, you know, what I call an identity wheel. So we carry that within us. And understanding that that's a framework that we can hold on to. Each, at the end of each of those spokes, then is each of those different factors. And then we have to think, okay, how is that factor for that particular coachee or client that we're working with? How does it show up internally and externally, and what might be the difference? Equally, again, what's the relationship between how they self-identify? If we go with class, for example, how they might self-identify might then be very different to how they are actually viewed in terms of their class. And it helps us then understand, okay, so how they're being related to is based on a perceived class rather than a self-identified class. But again, it's that dynamical relationship between the two that helps us then to understand, okay, what might be going on in terms of that client's then lived experience. Going back to Lou's example of the code switching, absolutely. That is code switching that I think is a great example of how our intersectionality, our identity is impacted by that feedback loop, that relationship between internal and external. And code switching does exactly what it says on the tin, because you're having to switch up your internal code to something that's an external code that's more acceptable, or more, what's deemed as more appropriate, or allows you to give a sense of more belonging to that particular situation that you're in. So for me, it's this cultural wheel or identity wheel. And I'm always thinking, okay, how do the different spokes interconnect? And how does that identity wheel as a whole change from internal to external?
And as I think about that, I get an image of a spider's web, because it's not just the spokes going out into infinitum, but they're all kind of coming back and crossing over themselves and interconnected, and thus creating those feedback loops. And it makes me begin to think about, so, you know, when I'm working with a client, I can start to maybe notice those nodes at the code switching or the external internal kind of challenges showing up when they are struggling with either making a choice about something or how they're dealing with a situation. Because what sort of comes to mind is this idea that, you know, Robert shows up in a particular environment and the desire to be the self is being pushed, but then the external world is reading him as something else, so that's being triggered. And so he kind of gets caught in this, well, who am I then? And how do I be me? Because they see me as one thing, I feel me as something else. And this kind of context says I should be maybe a third thing. And so it sort of makes me think, oh yeah, when clients are struggling with this sense of self and you know, that lostness, it could be because these intersections are all pushing and pulling against each other without an overarching view of what might this mean.
And I think I think what's really beautiful about that imagery is the role that it has for the coach as well, because how do we show up? What signs are we presenting to the coachee that you know, that whichever self shows up, whatever they present, it's okay that, you know, they're not being judged on that. Are we aware of our own language and the questions that we're asking and the focus that, you know, we're working with the coachee? Are we accidentally re-traumatizing, you know, old cultural trauma or individual trauma by you know, it might just be so one of the common instances that I see is somebody who has explained that they prefer they them pronouns and you're constantly referring to them as he or she. Are we doing the work to help them bring the self out that they want to present rather than the ones they think they should be presenting?
Yeah, that's really interesting in the sense of language, and really hearing the language that our clients are using when describing the self and tuning into that. It also made me think a lot about the work of sort of Carl Rogers and that person-centered approach and meeting the clients where they are. So by doing that, meeting them in that space, creating a safety in that space to show up as they are, and if they show up differently, to be okay with that different and not to go, wait a minute, Robert, you showed up like this yesterday, now you're showing up like this, what's wrong? Because it isn't necessarily a wrong, it's just a different self showing up, which I think it really plays out in relationships. You know, different things impact us and we return home or to our partner or to our friends or family, and they see a different us showing up, but it's just a facet of the whole showing up. And then there is this, you know, the assumptions that are made about how we're showing up, which then create those sometimes challenging conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. What came to my mind, Robert, in you just saying that is, you know, this idea of different kind of facets or different sides of the client might show up, or anyone that we're in relationship to. I think we also have to acknowledge that what influences which side shows up is also our identity and our intersect. So there's something about some clients will code switch based on who their therapist or coach is, but then may not feel that they have to do that based on the identity of their therapist or coach. So I think there's something around, and again, something that I teach a lot on, which is when we talk about relationships, we're talking about two identities in the room, therefore two intersectionalities. So how a client or coachee shows up is fundamentally influenced by who are they in relationship with. So between the three of us, we go, if we did a case study or a scenario, a hypothetical scenario in which we all had the same client coming to us, who they will present and who they will be, it would be as if we were working with three different people. And it's purely because who we show up in our intersectionalities and what's visible in our identity is going to impact on a client or anybody else, like you said, friend or family member, about who they think we are as well. And so it's a constant dynamic, and again, unique in the relationship, because the space between the two people, the relationship that then is created between two people, is influenced and based purely on the feedback loop between those two people.
Yeah, I it reminds me of the work around paradigms and worldviews, this idea that there isn't a single worldview in the space. Once there's more than one person, there are multiple worldviews at play, and they are impacting against each other, and they're vying for not so much dominance, but they're vying to be heard and to be witnessed. But also sometimes that vying creates a different response. So with one of us, somebody might be very talkative. With another, they may be very quiet, and that's the sort of the worldview that's pushing against them, or the intersect or the relational aspect that's showing up because of the dynamic that's set up between us, or because of the social landscape that they are occupying because of the relationship that they believe or perceive to be at play in that moment. I feel like we could disappear in language as we talk about this. And it makes me wonder about, you know, as a coach that's sort of listening to this or watching this, and they're sort of going, okay, but what do I do with this idea that, you know, there are multiple facets to someone, or sections or intersections to someone. And this shows up in the coaching space. As a coach, what might one do with that in terms of, you know, reaching goals or dealing with challenges?
Shall I?
Go for it, Myra.
Sorry. I think for me, and it links back to your point a moment ago, Robert, this idea about, oh, there's two in the room. I always talk about there then being two truths in the room, because you know how you were talking about, oh, they then vie for dominance. I think the first thing then that as counsellors and as coaches that we need to, in a way, be really conscious of, mindful of and aware of, is that can we sit with two truths in the room, mine and my client's? By giving value, respect and honour to two truths, it means then that I can put mine to one side for that session and empathize with the truth of my client. Because otherwise what we end up doing is then as a client then presents their narrative and start, we do the work with them. Anything then that might come up that, as you were talking about the worldviews or any kind of core belief or anything that is a lived experience of the client that doesn't kind of resonate with our own truth, I don't think we then hold it to the same level of value or respect unless we recognize, hold on a minute, a client's truth does not dismiss or eradicate mine. Because I think that's the worry, is that, oh my goodness, if I sit with a client's truth and lived experience and empathize with it, it somehow then invalidates my own. And so for me, it's about two truths in the room. Mine I can put to one side, because to sit and empathize and work with a client's truth does not take away from my experience. But what I can do is then really value and work with the clients, because then the goals and the aims and the objectives of the work we're doing with that client then is relevant and appropriate then to their lived experience.
And this is really interesting, because I often think about, you know, the coaches that we train at Animus, we talk a lot about working with what's true for the client. We talk about bracketing our own stuff or parking it. But I guess there is the unconscious stuff that kicks in. And this is where that sort of self-awareness is so important, and self-reflection. Because I would imagine that I can sit there and go, this is my client's truth, and I'm going to hold that as their truth in the space right now. But if it goes against a real core part of me, that unconscious bit of me is going to be at play, or that kind of brain chatter is going to be working away in the background, which kind of really lends itself to self-reflection and self-understanding and self-recognition, so that part of us doesn't feel like it's under attack in some shape or form.
Yeah, and it's a big part of so it's my approach to the work that I do, coaching and training allies, and so that kind of self-reflexivity that we practice as coaches becomes this massive, you know, becomes this massive resource that we have, of being able to kind of work on our own kind of bias and our worldviews, but also where we have spared injustice, and to acknowledge and remember that we can practice empathy, but we are not the complex mess of each human being in front of us or even within ourselves. And so, like you said, with Carl Rogers, and being present with who they want to be with in that moment, who they want to be in that moment, really helps us respect that process of going, okay, you know, when you hear that internal chatter, you know, as allies, it's the thing that I coach with allies, is okay, but it's not about you. This space is not about you. Remember why you're here, you know, and listen to the stories, because that's how we learn. And I think that's, for me, I'd had this really long dialogue between me as a sociologist and me as a philosopher and me as a coach. There's really big picture stuff and really individual stuff, and intersectionality really helped me blend those together by understanding that there are these big huge cultural narratives going on. How could that inform large groups? What does that mean for them? And then remembering that might inform my client. It also might not, because there's this whole other aspect of their identities that might be to do with their level of education, the life choices that they want to make, whether they want to, get married and have kids, all of the stuff around, you know, life stage theories. It might not apply. And so, okay, I don't know who's going to show up in front of me, so I'm just going to listen and I'm going to be with whoever's here. And I think there's something quite liberating. And, you know, kind of speaking from a new coach, where you're quite daunted by, you don't know what's going to come out. But then there's this liberation of, I don't know what's going to come out. Let's see.
It's something, you know, really resonates with me, the idea of, as a new coach, we can sometimes, I say as a new coach and as an experienced coach, we can sometimes get caught up in this idea of who's going to show up in front of me and how do I then work with who shows up. And we can get into planning and hypothesizing, as opposed to, getting into being present with what is showing up and how we relate to what is showing up. And something you said earlier, Myra, about, you know, how we are influences and impacts how our clients show up. So how do we get into a good place so that we're not unconsciously or even consciously triggering them in some way, which also makes me think about the environment in which we show up and how we have to manage our environment. So it's not just the individual, the self, it's the self and the environment, because we have no notion of what might be a trigger or a push to make somebody show up differently. But all we can do is do our best to be ourselves in the showing up that allows them to be themselves in the showing up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is something around. It is not just in the relationship of the work we are doing with the client. It is also about what is it that we are modeling in being with the client. And exactly that, it's to recognize that, again, going back to your idea, Robert, of, you know, we can spend, again, each coach or counselor can sit and spend hours beforehand looking through an assessment, hypothesizing, and you can do that for infinity. It's not until you get into the room with the client or the coachee do you really get a sense then of, well, what is this about? What is it that they're bringing? What is it that they want to work on? But also, how we're going to work with it. The process itself is impacted and influenced by my identity and also influenced and impacted by the identity of the client as well. And so we have to hold on to this kind of parallel process that's going on, this double layer or dual layer process of, we're doing the work, but the work itself is being done by these two particular individual people and their identities. So the outcome of it is going to be a reflection of who we are and what we're doing.
And I think there's something really key there about that sort of role modeling piece as a coach or as a practitioner of, you know, walking your talk. So not just getting your clients to set goals and do the deep work, but how are we doing that deep work as well? How are we looking at how we are made up and the different parts of ourselves that show up at any particular time? How are we addressing that so that we model that work as opposed to just go, you do the work and I'll sit here. It's a bit like if you're, I don't know, your gym instructor is really out of shape. There's something incongruent there and out of balance, which doesn't create a sort of a harmonic relationship, I guess. So we've kind of spoken about the idea of intersectionality, the sort of the framework or the wheel that sits with it, and we talked a lot about as the individual, the coach and the coachee within this work. And I'm also curious here about the organization that sits with this. Now, whether that's the training organization or a work organization that one might go into to work with, because, you know, we can recognize that as a coach, you might want to work in this way, but without the sort of the tools or the information about how this works, then you can't address this. You can't have a voice around it. So I'm curious about how you work with organizations or with training around this work and what that sort of brings to the space for you. Maybe if we start with Lou first.
Yeah, I'd love to. And funnily enough, it's through storytelling.
We lost you a little bit there. So we
go with Myra for now.
So we began to hear stuff though around the narrative and the story that's being presented and the exploration of stories, and you know, we can really recognize how powerful stories are. When I teach coaching, I talk about this idea that, you know, our minds are tuned into stories. We want to hear stories and hear those narratives play out, and sometimes the issues or the challenges that we're faced with is because we're caught in those story loops and we're not sort of challenging the story as they present themselves.
Yeah, and I think there's something really powerful, because when we're looking at organizational culture and we're looking at the people within them, there are so much wealth in stories of people's experiences. And so, you know, I have very strong feelings about how helpful unconscious bias training can be, and actually use the resources that you have. Know that the people who are, you know, who are managing those stakeholder relationships, managing their presentations themselves, being able to provide spaces for them to be able to go, okay, yeah, sure, we all work in the finance department, but actually, because of these different aspects of myself, my experience working here isn't the same as yours. You know, and by allowing people to have that space means that organizations can then address the things that are particularly pertinent to them. And so, yeah, for me, it's the technical stuff, anybody can teach, but it's about the personal, because these are your people, it's their stories, it's all of the things that led them to be in that space. But I know that it's a big ask, because it's so much easier to just tick off, yep, we've done unconscious bias training, yep, we've had some coaching for our managers, great, but how about actual transformational change that's long lasting and that is cultivated and created by the people who make up that culture.
And as you were talking there about, you know, there's the sort of the company culture at the center, and then there are the people around that, it made me think back to Myra's wheel and this idea that, you know, that the company is made up of the intersections of the people that are part of that organization. And therefore, how do we give those parts a voice so that the company can really live true to the voices of those that are part of that organization? And it made me think about the discord that you can sometimes get within an organization, because part of its identity isn't being heard or isn't being given the attention it requires or wants or needs. And therefore, you can kind of get this kind of clunkiness with an organization. And it's kind of triggered some thoughts there for me about organizational culture. And Myra, what's when you think about your work with organizations, how does this sit with you?
Yeah, kind of very similar to what Lou was saying, in terms of I go in and deliver training into organizations, and clearly, because of this year and because of Black Lives Matter and all this work now being invested into anti-racism and organisations wanting to become an anti-racist organisation, I'm going in now and delivering a lot of workshops looking at actually intersectionality, looking at identity, looking at the relationship between people. Because absolutely, when we're talking about organisations, again, we're looking at relationships between people, or a relationship between employees and an employer, or a relationship between people who work in an organization and the organization in and of itself as an identity. And we have to be mindful then that, again, there is this constant feedback loop between those two identities. And like Lou was saying, an organization isn't homogenous. So just as we might have categories for different aspects of our identity, so we might say, you know, all women, or middle-class people, for example, it becomes such a homogenizing term that we then discount the rest of their identity and go, well, then all women are like X, and then all middle-class people are like Y, for example. The same thing happens in organizations, in which everyone then all of a sudden is labeled an employee. And in doing so, the rest of their identities are completely invalidated, are hidden and are made invisible. And so then an organizational culture is then created in which those at the top or sit dominantly in the organization then, and this is where the unconscious bias piece can also play out, those people at the top then in those dominant positions create an organizational culture that actually is their normative or their normal, their neutral position with things, thinking it's normative for everyone else in the organization. And of course, that's not true. So it's recognizing that it is a relationship between lots of individuals, and not everyone's experience is the same purely because they all work there. And so what gets positioned as normative or neutral In terms of, oh, that's, for example, if an organisation say something on the lines of, well, this is how we've always done it, that for me is an example of a normative culture or process, which then loads of other people go, well, that might be how we do it, but it doesn't mean that it actually works for us or is even appropriate for us to do. So I think this is where organisational culture is now meeting unconscious bias and intersectionality.
I feel like we're talking about something other here as well as what we're talking about. I have this sense that there's something greater happening in this conversation than just talking about intersectionality or organizations or unconscious bias. I can't quite put my finger on what that is, but it feels like, I don't know, are we talking about how society relates to itself and each other? Are we talking about, you know, the sort of the global change that we're facing right now through pandemic and politics, and, you know, the sort of the shifting sands that one might feel in the space? But it feels like, yes, we're talking about these ways of working and how we might work with an organization, but it also feels like there's something almost bigger in the conversation than I'm able to kind of put my finger on right now. I'm not sure what your sense is of that might be.
I can sum it up in two words. I'm tired. I think so much of that fatigue, you know, so we have the kind of battle fatigue that people from marginalized groups are experiencing as people are becoming more aware of those stories, of those experiences that maybe they don't, you know, that they're spared from. People who are aspiring to be allies, they're excited and they're driven to help, but they're also then sharing that fatigue that those of us who might be on receiving ends of discrimination or prejudice, they're sharing that with us, and so they're tired. And this is on top of, you know, their own concerns, their own mental well-being, their own responsibilities. And I think we're now getting to that. It's just that meme, isn't it? Just everyone's exhausted. And we don't want to be like this forever. And so, and you can hear my existentialism coming, the dread, that dread that we feel. I think we're motivated to make some changes. And part of that is, and for me, the difficult dialogue is, you know, so there's a huge argument against intersectionality, you know, saying that it's a myth, and actually it itself is used to divide groups rather than bring them together, which I'm more than happy to go into arguments with outside of this podcast. But for me, it's about, if we understand intersectionality and we remove the power aspect from it just for a minute, we are all complex humans that are driven by lots of different things, but we also have internal conflict. So some of those selves, some of those identities will conflict in themselves. And so when we talk about doing that work first, so part of the thing that I say within allyship, that it might not be about you, but it starts with you. And if we can do that work for ourselves and learn to be kind to ourselves, kinder to other people, giving people the space and the permission and access to power and resources to heal. So for me, that's kind of how I feel it, Rob. Like, that's what I'm feeling, is this real urge to just rest, but wake up from this seeming unending nightmare that we're in.
I love that existential language. And Myra, what does it sort of show up like for you?
It's interesting that we're talking about kind of this feeling of feeling tired. I agree that it's tiring, but I think it feels like it's tiring because it feels like standing in the ocean and we've been knocked over by the first wave, and then the next one comes and the next one, and every time a new wave comes, we're more exhausted to actually be able to kind of get back up on our feet again. And so it feels like that we're being literally flooded by so much that we're trying to just make sense of for ourselves, of our own lived experience, but then going, oh, but then we've also got to understand that about everyone else that we're relating to or connected with as well. But I think when you talk, Robert, about this, what we're starting to kind of touch upon is something that feels far bigger. I think for me, the key thing and what feels bigger is that what feels previously something that was just held as something unconscious, something that was held as that's just the way things are, and what was positioned previously as normative, neutral, I think we're now starting to give it its more relevant weight to it. So, and what I mean by that is that anything that previously was just deemed as, well, this is just normal, this is my experience, we're starting to place on a value spectrum, and we're starting to see that if something now actually is not normative but privileged, we're now giving it and identifying and naming it for what it is, because wherever it falls on that spectrum of power through to oppression, its opposite will also be present as well. And I think for far too long, we have positioned everything as privileged in the middle of the spectrum and as neutral and as normative. We only ever looked at the bottom half of the spectrum. I think the bigger picture and the bigger thing I think we're talking about is, oh, we've now started to reveal the top end of that spectrum, and we're calling out now and naming where that privilege exists. Because as I think, as Lou, you mentioned earlier, it's far more comfortable, I think, to identify where there is oppression in society, where there is injustice in society, where the the struggles, the challenges, the difficulties, the marginalised and minority communities. But they can only occur if there are communities that are benefiting from the current societal systems and frameworks and structures. And so I think the bigger picture we're talking about is almost a bit like a ta-da, we now have revealed that actually, if we talk about minority marginalised issues and communities and lived experiences, we have to also talk about the other side. And I think for far too long, it's a bit like a coin. We've only ever looked at one side of the coin. Mm. What we're starting to identify is that actually that other side exists now. And we can, and to talk about one, we have to talk about the other. I think that's the bigger thing we're sitting in.
And this is fascinating, because I sit here and I go, that feels very relevant, and it feels very now that we are starting to go, so what is this world made up of, and who is this world made up of, and how are these people showing up, and what's the power advantage or disadvantage that sits with that, and at the same time being able to go, and so how do I sit with that as an individual, and what are all those parts within me, so where is my power and my powerlessness as the individual, which kind of makes me sort of see it as intersectionalities, both this kind of meta and micro view. So you've got this kind of tiny, well, not tiny for the individual, but this kind of my view of what's happening in my internal world, my internal makeup. And then I've also got the societal view of what's happening and how that sort of influences itself and me as a part of it. So it feels like this real duality at play sort of in society and in the individual. And perhaps right now the why this is gaining so much traction is because we're finding the language to name these ways of being, both for the individual and for society. And we're starting to see how they sit in parallel, as opposed to just them being different and outside of the self. So I feel like there is so much that we could delve into here. I'm sure people that are watching and listening will be like, well, I want to talk about that bit, and I want to talk about that bit, and I want to delve into that bit. So I think to sort of give them an avenue for conversation, it would be great if you could share where people would be able to get hold of you, or maybe have further conversations with you. If we could start with Lou first. Oh, I think we've just lost Lou.
I am on LinkedIn, and so any other social media, I'm nowhere near as hot on. But my website is louchu.com, and more than happy for people to reach out. My email address is hello@louchu.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Lou. And Myra?
Yeah, similarly, you can find me on LinkedIn, and I'm on lots of other social media as well. So you can easily find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. But yeah, LinkedIn, but also my website is myrakhancounselling.co.uk. So you can find me on there and all the different trainings and workshops that I do as well.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you both. And I think that I'm sort of left in a very reflective space around, you know, what makes me me or my individualness and what makes me me with the external impacts that are placed upon me and how society kind of has an impact on me as well. So I'm going to go away and do some thinking about that. But it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you. And I look forward to us having another one soon. Take care. Thank you.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.